Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is Tuesday, the 11th of June, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. A delight to have you all with us on this Tuesday. Let me introduce everybody. We have the governor coming to talk to Alan at, well, he's not coming. He'll pick up the phone, but you know, you get the idea. He'll be here at 10, from 10 to 10:30. So we have a lot of stories to fit in just 47 minutes. So let us get to it. Let me introduce everybody. A reminder, you can join us, panel@wamc.org if you'd like to get your thoughts in. We'd love to hear what you have to say within reason. Dean of International Studies at Bard College and Academic Director at the Bard Globalization and International Affairs Program, Jim Ketterer, joins us 2 days in a row. We've won the lottery. Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Good to have you here. Libby Post is with us, political consultant. Missed yesterday, was out politicking, and is back today.
Yes, thank you. I'm lovely to be here. I was in the Big Apple.
Good to have you. Very good to have you. Mike Spanner, dear friend, is with us, and a former Times Union Associate Editor. Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
And J.P. Miller is back. He is he's a dad for the second time, and was missed with last week because his wife had a baby.
Yes.
And we checked in and we said, hey, you know, if you need the time off, that's fine. We just want you to know that you're invited. And he said, no, I need the time away. And yes, he's with us
you're
today.
You're all covered at home, though.
Yes. Good morning. And congratulations.
Thank you for having me. She was born during the fun drive. She's very happy.
Oh, excellent. Oh, she'll know the number by heart for the rest
Is
of her life.
Is there a mother-in-law to help out?
The mother and father-in-law to help out, and the baby was 9 days late, and she heard Alan on the radio say, get off the table, Mabel, and so that was it. She came out.
Well, congratulations.
We're very happy
to hear. It's nice when we can sit around this table and talk about joyous news. That is rare. Alan Chartok, good morning. How are you, sir?
Hi, Joe. How things?
Things be fine.
How's things?
Things be fine, and we're here and we're ready to go. We have a lot to talk about, so let's get started. We begin with the Mueller House deal. This is the Justice Department agreeing to turn over key Mueller evidence to the House. The Justice Department, after weeks of tense negotiations, has finally agreed to provide Congress with key evidence collected by Robert Mueller that Democrats believe could shed light on possible obstruction of justice and abuse of power by President Trump. The precise scope, volume, or, and here's a key word, usefulness of the material was not immediately clear, but the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Representative Gerald Nadler of New York, said it would include, quote, interview notes, firsthand accounts of misconduct, and other critical evidence, end quote, that it was collected by Mr. Mueller from the White House and former officials. So, Alan, what do we do with this information?
Well, first of all, you approach it with some trepidation and some sense that maybe the stuff that we do know that Mr. Barr has turned out to be nothing more than a sort of lapdog for the president. And Mike, you're making a face. You don't think
there was an interesting analysis this week in the New York Times.
I saw it.
That made the case that he's sort of a unknown sometimes. You know, he's a little bit of his own.
I think they referred to him as the new Dick Cheney.
Yeah, the new Dick Cheney.
Is that a compliment?
Rather than being a lapdog for the president, he might be trying to push his own agenda and like Cheney did for
George
Bush.
That's just wrong. Yeah. No, he's a lapdog. He knew what he had to do to get the job. He got it. So now he's turning over information. The question I have is what gets turned over and what doesn't get turned over. And I don't think that he has any intention of letting them have what he doesn't want. The interesting thing here is that Mueller is, of course, watching all of this. And the fact that the president keeps attacking Mueller, which I think is incredibly stupid. You bite the one person who can really do you
stupid
in.
Stupid is as stupid does.
It just incentivizes him to, you know, to say, no, that's not everything, which he did once already after the original report came out. So it'll bear watching. Do I have any faith that the Justice Department is going to do the right thing here? I do not.
It does seem that the House wants to focus on questions of obstruction because I think You know, the questions around collusion with the Russians seem so nebulous. It's hard to act on them. It's hard to really find something that rises to the level of criminal activity, so it seems. But obstruction, I think, seems more likely for the House to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the connect the dots in the Mueller report is probably more about obstruction, because that's real laws being broken. You know, telling the little one, the former Attorney General Sessions, to fire the elf on the shelf, to fire.
I thought you were talking about a little lie. No, you were talking about a person. No. For God's sake,
the diminutive Attorney General, telling him to fire Sessions, telling everybody not to comply with these subpoenas. Don McGahn, Hope Hicks, all these people. To me, that is obstruction of justice when you're telling your people not to comply.
I'm surprised that Nadler is kind of going for this, because Barr has already shown a proclivity for providing documents that are helpful and holding back documents that aren't helpful. So what is the mechanism by which we're going to know what he's given and what he hasn't given to Nadler?
Exactly.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I think Nadler's playing both options. He isn't holding off on finding Barr in contempt of Congress, but that's still out there. It's a possibility. And he's going to look at what he gets and said, well, if this isn't good enough, he'll go and hold Barr in contempt of Congress.
And this is happening all in the midst of this fight raging in the Democratic Party over to impeach, not to impeach. People are taking up sides on that. And I think Nadler, maybe with this push forward on these issues of obstruction, is trying to carve out some middle ground in that fight.
Meanwhile, in Loudonville, the Siena College poll has come out, and let's just take New York as a microcosm, but two-thirds of New York voters believe special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation did not clear President Trump. But, Mike, they seem to be a bit unsure as to where to go next.
Right. 50% of New Yorkers are saying that case closed, even though they may not like Trump, and they may think that the evidence that Mueller came out with is damning. They really want to move on. And if New Yorkers, some of the bluest voters right. nationally, are ready to say, let's just move on, you can see the risk, as Jim was saying, of Democrats spending a lot of energy and a lot of time on impeachment when voters want to hear about, what are you going to do about health care? Right. What are you going to do right. about the economy?
Well, and I think Nancy Pelosi knows that.
Yeah,
she knows it, and she wants to keep them focused. But people are still, you know, there are the fringe or the farther left of the party right. that are pushing on this. And you know, unless it's a slam dunk, and we have to remember the Senate's not going to do anything with this.
And does it help you win in 2020?
And it doesn't, because right. what all it'll do is gin up Trump's people.
And a lot of these people are very Congress people are scared. They're scared that they're going to get a primary. They're scared that the activists are going to show up and beat them a la Crowley and AOC. And they are worried about that. Our wonderful congressman, who I like very much, Paul Tonko, has come over to the other side, to the impeachment side. Mm-hmm. They lose nothing by saying, I'm for impeachment. They
right.
lose nothing. So they do it, and it covers them in terms of a potential primary. You got this guy, what's his name, Steyer? Steyer going around spending a lot, millions of dollars, trying to take out people like the wonderful Richie Neal, who I have such respect for, sitting up there in Springfield, my district of comes all the way over to my district. It takes a lot of gumption to stand up to bullies like that.
Well, in the Siena poll, I agree with you, Mike, that there are a lot of contradictory
yeah,
53% numbers.
53% say that they believe he committed an impeachable right. offense, and yet they don't want it.
Right, and 59% say that he obstructed justice, but only 45% want impeachment. That's yeah. a huge difference. And then also, on collusion, 50% of New Yorkers say no proof of collusion, which I thought was also kind of high for New York State, which you'd think is a more progressive state, and you'd think there are more people that would think there was collusion.
But we'd like some proof. You know, that's the thing about New Yorkers. We want to see the facts. And since we can't see the full report, we can't see the facts.
Well, you're all thinking that these guys may be intellectuals, the people who are answering these polls. they haven't read the report. They don't know anything, most of them. So we sit around here and pontificate and say, you know, the, go ahead.
No, but don't you think that that's what Nadler is looking for? He's looking for that sound bite. He's looking for a clip. He's looking for some short little tweetable thing that says the president deliberately stopped the investigation in violation
of the law. The smoking
gun. That's what he wants.
Yeah.
The smoking howitzer is what he wants.
And he's not wrong. I read an interesting thing in the paper, I think today, which said that Trump had called Nadler when he was in the hospital.
Oh, right. He had passed out. Yeah.
So that's fascinating that, you know, that's the way this game has been played.
Well, they must know each other from way back.
They go way back.
Oh, no, yes. They go way back. Oh,
yeah.
Way back.
Yeah.
He was his assemblyman, wasn't he?
Yeah. But, you know, in New York, Trump was a well-known giver of money to everybody, including, I believe, Andrew Cuomo.
Yes.
Back in the day. And, you know, it's only recently, because of the positioning that he's had to become president, that he has stopped supporting Democrats. In fact, for a while, I think he was a registered Democrat. I'm not sure about that.
But well, he had to avoid investigations, so he gave to the attorney general,
sure,
gave to the district attorney, and never was investigated until he became president.
And he boasted during his presidential campaign that he gave money to everybody because he wanted something in return. He wanted them to come and do things for him,
right,
and that
so
was the way he did it. It was transactional.
Quid pro quo.
And in the meantime, think about, I challenge all of you to answer this question. If you were a New York State voter, particularly if you lived in New York City, here's the trick question. What do you think the number one thing on your mind is right now? Is it Trump? No. Is it healthcare? No. What is it?
Subway.
You got it.
I don't think so.
No.
I think it's your rent.
Oh, okay.
I think it's rent control.
And the cost of living, yes,
yeah.
The cost of your housing.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, you know, you're spending half your money or a quarter of your money on your rent every month, and now there's a sense that the greedy landlords are going to have their way.
Mm-hmm.
And how much money do those landlords give to these politicians? A ton of money,
It's one of the big the real estate and car dealers are the two biggest.
I get the real estate. Could you fill me in on why the car dealers?
Well, somebody explained it to me that, Ford can't come here and open up a Ford store. They have to work through dealers. They can't sell directly to the public.
Under New York State law.
New York State law. Yeah. And so they want to protect that. That Tesla, if they ever actually make cars, they want to come in and sell directly to consumers and circumvent the dealers. And so
the dealers give the money.
Yeah, it's the dealers. The auto dealers give a lot of money, too.
So in the few minutes we have before we go to break, let us just bring all of these stories together and talk about the other poll that was in the New York Times, which I just think some stories are just fun. No matter how you look at them, they're fun. But a statewide poll suggests that President Trump is better liked than Mayor Bill de Blasio. He has become the most unpopular. He has become even more unpopular since declaring his 2020 candidacy and now has one of the lowest approval ratings of any mayor of New York City. I believe among registered voters who responded to the poll, 34% had a favorable opinion of Mr. Trump, 63% had an unfavorable opinion for a net negative of 29%, but Mayor de Blasio only has 29%.
Unbelievable.
I think the first thing I would say before we get into the specifics about the mayor is that being a mayor is a very tough job.
Yep.
I mean, that's a job where you have to – you're the – one responsible for picking up the garbage. You're the one responsible for making things work. You know, when you're a legislator, you're removed from the implementation of the policies that you're working on. So, and then being mayor of New York City is another order of magnitude.
Well, we had a poster at home, John Lindsay, the second toughest job in America. You know,
you now have term limits, right? So. Is that a good idea to have two term limits, two
two sessions.
You mean that a New York City mayor be limited to two terms?
Yeah,
which they do. President has it.
So. Yeah, and that sort of is the New York City mayor, and you can see the backlash that Mike Bloomberg faced when he found a way to circumvent that. And
it
go
was
for a third
it was
term.
Really nasty. Yeah. What he did is he basically bought it.
Yeah.
He said to the city council, "Change the law, and I'll let you have a third term too." And that's how they did it.
And Mike and I were talking briefly about this before the show, but the poll was statewide, but it is New Yorkers, the New York City people hate him the most, right?
Yeah, I mean, there seems to be this at least
which makes sense.
You know, I don't care much for him, and then people like to beat up on him. I mean, and you know, I guess that doesn't matter. Trump was from New York, and New York went heavily for Hillary. And he still succeeded across the country. Maybe de Blasio thinks it doesn't matter how he's playing at home as long as he plays well in Peoria.
Except that
he's not.
He's not. Iowa, didn't even, like, register.
Right, the Iowa poll.
Well, we knew who Ed Koch was, right?
Yes, because...
But you knew who he was. I've never had the feeling I had the slightest idea what de Blasio is really all about.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yet he cruised to victory in his re-election. You know, what's wrong with the electoral system if everybody dislikes him and nobody can run against him?
Well, not everybody. There were the real estate industry likes him very much, I believe.
Maybe the car dealers.
But didn't we said that in New York State, too, about Governor Cuomo, that if you looked at the primary maps, there were swaths of the state that people who knew him, the Democrats, didn't like him,
upstate.
And yet they still, right, upstate, well, here, Buffalo, Rochester, Utica, but New York City was overwhelming.
Yeah, and what happens is these Democrats, because of the numbers, have weak opponents. The Republicans aren't able to put up strong candidates.
Not in blue state New York.
Not incompetent candidates, just candidates who have wide popularity. And maybe that's one of the big reasons Ed Koch is no longer the GOP chairman. Yeah.
Well, you know, I like Ed Koch. I've always liked him. But I have to say, you know, they suffered one disgraceful defeat after another. And, you know, after a while, as much as you like a guy, your constituents, in other words, the county chairman, say, out with them, get somebody else in here, and it's never going to be any better.
Rick Langworthy is going to be really interesting to watch. He's going to be a lot more colorful, a lot more bombastic. He's a, you know, Carl Palladino kind of clone.
But think of Carl Palladino.
I know.
You know, he never got beans.
I know, but I saw Langworthy. He gave one of the rebuttals at the LCA show, the Legislative Correspondent show. Yeah, and I know you don't go anymore, honey. Ever since you were a spark plug. You know,
no,
but
a fire hydrant with a necktie.
Yes, well, that's the same thing as spark plug.
No, it's not.
Okay. So, yes, you're a fire hydrant.
No, it is not.
You're right.
We have a
right.
break. Well, right. Let's take a break, and then we'll figure out some fire hydrants.
It was.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Mike Spain, J.P. Miller, Libby Post, Jim Ketterer, and Alan Chartok, who has letters for us, and we'll start with those now.
Well, thank you, Joe. Chuck says, Alan is 100% correct. That's where I'm going to stop, right there. another stalling tactic by the grifters who hijacked our government. How naive can you be? You'll get garbage from Barr, and he should be held in contempt with... Oh, yeah, thank you, Joe. He should be held in contempt with no more attention paid to diversions. It only serves to erode support from the Democrats, and that's Chuck from Southfield, Massachusetts. Wonderful place, Southfield.
It is a timing game, though, isn't it, though?
Yeah.
If they impeach him too quickly, then Mitch McConnell can control when the Senate trial will be, and you know the outcome of that already. And then if he times it just right into the spring of next year, that'll become, you know, Trump's campaign thing. They tried to get rid of me, and they couldn't.
Yeah. The one thing in that letter, though, that I just want to be a little bit careful about is the phrase, hijack the government. And so that maybe it's not what the letter writer is saying, but if what they're saying is that Trump wouldn't not have won without Russian collusion, as Libby was saying before, I don't think we have evidence of that.
But on the other hand, Jim, we will never know.
Yeah, I think that if we engage in that kind of thinking, though, it's sort of magical thinking, rather than saying, look, electoral college, that's rules of the game. There is a base of support for Donald Trump that is separate from the Russians. Now, the Russians were playing a heavy disinformation game, and it worked to a T for the Russians, but that's not necessarily what swung the election.
No, you're right. But I think also when we hear the grifters who hijacked the government, it should be taken in a different way, which is these guys have put out false messages and everything else, and that's part of the hijacking
process. Right, right.
But Jim, you make such a good point. What you fail to understand when you kind of blame it on Russian interference is that there is a strong base still today for Donald Trump. And people ought to be aware of that. And they look at things differently. They hear a different narrative on Fox News, for example, and they see things in a whole different way. And understanding what they're looking at and the pain that they're going through is really important for people if they want to address that and have a successful
campaign.
Well,
that's a nice way of putting it.
Yes.
A not-so-nice way of putting it is what Hillary said. You know, we're talking about this basket.
But that's not it, though, Alan. They're not all deplorable people.
No, I know that. Yeah, I know that. Yeah. But there are a lot of people who hate black people in that group. There are a lot of people who hate Muslims in that group. There are a lot of people who don't believe anybody else should be coming into this country in that group. You know, they're not all terribly attractive, and I'm not going to play the violin for you, Michael. While you say that there's some good people in there.
Well, and because of that, the Democrats it looks like are going to put up the, you know, wealthy white old candidate that will appeal to those people in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania.
Well, so what would you do? JP, would you, or is it PJ? JP, what would you do? Would you not do that? I mean,
no, I'd put up Biden for sure.
You'd want to win, yeah. Wouldn't you?
Sure.
And yeah. You want to get this guy out of there.
But doesn't Biden right now seem a lot like Jeb Bush was at this point in the 2016 race?
I mean, to me, anyway.
Yeah.
It just seems like
he's going to burn out.
Well, he could. And yeah. I've been watching his face when he's getting up there to talk. He looks a little palish, to be honest with you. He does. He doesn't look like...
He's also not campaigning very hard from a lot of press reports, so it's hard to burn out when you're not campaigning hard.
Is that a strategy that's been effective so far? He's not showing up when other people do.
He's showing up today in Iowa.
Yeah.
And apparently he's going to be quite vitriolic, we are told.
Well, we'll see.
Well, you know, he'll
I think it's a good strategy for him not to get burned out.
Right. And they're keeping him, also to be somewhat gaffe-free. I mean, last week, saying flipping on the Hyde Amendment was not great. I was really shocked when he said he still supported the Hyde Amendment. I thought, you know, what century are you in? But
a lot of Democrats do.
Well,
for political reasons.
Because of their districts.
Or for religious reasons.
Or for religious and personal
Well,
reasons.
But if you're going to do the Hyde Amendment is about no federal funding for abortion, which, you know, that's different. There's no religious thing there. If you're going to oppose abortion for religious reasons, oppose it across the board.
Okay, fair enough, Libby. You're right. I'm not going to argue about that with you. Peter says impeachment. One, the impeachment of Bill Clinton was concocted out of nothing more than animosity. It was a punishment looking for a crime. But Trump's offenses are serious. If you don't impeach for this, what do you impeach for? Two, a lot of political issues are looked at in the context of what happened last time. The Republicans were hurt by the failure of the Clinton impeachment, so it's assumed that any impeachment without a conviction would have the same result for the party that initiated it, regardless of the merits. But if the case is presented effectively, it might expose the senators who vote to acquit as gutless.
That's an interesting point because, you know, we're so focused on the presidential race in 2020, but what's going to go on with these Senate races and how could impeachment corner some of these senators that are in tough races, GOP senators?
Or Democratic senators. Isn't the ultimate impeachment the unseating of a sitting president?
Although there'll be people listening who say, nonsense, Michael. What's really happening here is we are doing what the Constitution told us to. And they believe that. Many people who call me, write me, text me are basically saying you don't have a choice whether it's popular or not. You have to do it because the guy's a bum and because he's done that. Right? No?
No.
Okay. But the thing about the senators are there's an assumption that the Senate is going to stay Republican. there is an assumption that the Senate will stay Republican. I think they had a shot, but some of their best people are in the thousands who are running for president right now.
Yeah. Right. Montana's governor is running for presidential.
Wouldn't it be possible for Beto O'Rourke to run for Senate instead of?
Yes, and that's what people are saying.
And Hickenlooper in Colorado.
Right. Yeah. But this guy from Montana, he may be end up being the sleeper of this entire campaign. He is somebody who can speak to middle America. He's a Democrat who has crossed the aisle and gotten things done in Montana that no one's been able to get done before. And he could end up being a pivotal player in all of this.
That ain't going to happen.
Hey, quick, what's his name?
I don't.
See, that's the problem.
I knew it when I saw him on 60 Minutes.
And Joe, as soon as you
heard, it's true.
As soon as you heard Libby saying that guy from Montana.
Yeah, well, that's the problem, right? We don't know who
the people are.
Thank God for Google.
It's like, you know.
Well, we're going to get him on the TV soon for the debates. We're going to start to know names. Remember the name Herman Cain? We all know that name. We're going to start to learn all of them. It's going to be awesome.
Okay, Tracy says, name calling? I find it curious the panel has no problem making fun of people's appearances, calling Sessions names for one. How does that make you any better than President Trump? And that's from Tracy. Oh,
God. Well, I think we're past where we characterize people by their appearance.
I couldn't remember his name. I could remember what I could remember is Kate McKinnon's portrayal.
And John says, dear panel, what is so surprising here about the Nadler deal? Nadler's own peers found his committee subpoenas to be overly broad. The only 1+= 2 is that Nadler had to back down because courts will find that Congress can't view the grand jury data because it would be illegal. I'm pretty sure we will find the evidence content where the Justice Department is previously offered. Which the Justice Department previously offered, unless Nadler wants to look like a bigger fool, he had to accept the legal reality. John writes this on, let's just say, the other side every once in a while. And then we heard from Robert, who said, Congress of baboons. The House seems to be getting stuff done, keeping in mind their bills are not moving once they get to the Senate. As to holding Trump's feet to the fire, keep doing both, hold hearings in preparation for impeachment, take it slow, but keep going, says Robert. And then finally, Andre says, Democrats will win in 2020 by focusing on the substance of their policies. Persevering on impeachment will cripple that opportunity to resonate with voters and court disaster. And that's Andre from Takata.
So I think in those letters we see the whole spectrum of the thoughts on impeachment.
I agree with you. I agree with you. I'm hearing more now. Basically, the earlier letters were always for impeachments and get off the table. Now we're hearing more of the Pelosi thing.
Mm-hmm. People recognize that this is not an easy thing to be able to do and that the politics just aren't there.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll go for our last 15 minutes before the governor joins Alan, and we'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Tuesday morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Jim Ketterer, J.P. Miller, Libby Post, and Mike Spain make up the group this morning, and we, again, thank you for being with us. All right, so let's go to other stories. Hey, John Dean testified yesterday after a detour to Watergate. House Democrats gained little traction on impeachment. Pro-impeachment Democrats are struggling to make their case. We've been talking about this for ousting President Trump to a wary public. But yesterday, it was John Dean who made the connections yesterday, saying that there certainly were connections to be made between what was happening in this administration, the parallels between Trump and his former boss, Richard Nixon, though he acknowledged he was not a fact witness. It's quite striking and startling that history is repeating itself, and with a vengeance. So that's why I have spoken out, John Dean told the Judiciary Committee.
I think it was a stupid move.
Just doesn't move the needle at all,
right.
I don't think.
Why did they do this? It didn't add anything to them. It gave Republicans the ability to mock the Democrats.
And it's very easily mockable.
Yeah, it really is. And
well, it was nothing that he hasn't said on cable
news.
Right,
that's the thing. That's right. You know, yeah. And so what, you know, that's not what a... a hearing, congressional hearing is for. A congressional hearing is to uncover, and that's not, he didn't uncover anything.
Well, it's not unusual for a congressional committee to bring in some expert testimony, and I guess because John Dean was involved in the biggest political scandal of our lifetime, Watergate.
So far.
So far, that he might be an expert, but I agree. Yeah, it just makes it easy to ridicule the whole process.
And the president did.
Yes,
he stood
up
in front of the helicopter.
Called him a loser.
And he said John Dean went to jail. And John Dean is a convicted felon, and John Dean is this and that. Story over, he said.
Yeah.
He's good at sound bites. That guy is clever at sound bites.
Letters.
Okay, Jonathan writes deplorables. Hillary did not say Trump supporters are all deplorables. She said half of them were.
Good point.
She may have been erring on the low side, and that's from Jonathan. Okay, good morning. Didn't the Donald take an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States? Isn't he openly advocating defiance of legal subpoenas? What's to investigate? We have no choice but to impeach John Y. in Sandersfield. And Neil writes, impeachment polls. The 55% who don't want impeachment include many people like Allen, who think it's a bad move for Democrats. If Pelosi came out for impeachment, the number of people supporting it would increase dramatically. And that's from Neil. Okay. And
yeah, but I think the question is, why is Nancy Pelosi not coming out? I mean, she's trying to play, you know, a long game on this. Mm-hmm. And she's
the long game, meaning get rid of Trump.
And maybe win some more Senate seats and et cetera. And so I don't think this is a question of just her turning around the opinion polls. She wants to win at the polls.
She's very brilliant, you know.
When she said,
I want to put him in jail. Now that, of course,
she knew
that that's something people would get, and it would show her creds when it came to getting rid of Trump.
I think that's also a lot easier to understand than high crimes and misdemeanors and impeachment, which is really a political act.
Sure.
Putting somebody in jail, that's a criminal prosecution. That's pretty clear.
Stephen said, Biden enthusiasm gap. Hold your nose and vote for Joe is a very bad idea. Enthusiasm across the board has various dimensions. You know this. That's from Stephen.
Yeah, whatever. I think that's a good point, Stephen. Yeah.
Okay.
Mike was making that point earlier.
That could be a lawn sign. Hold your nose and vote for Joe.
Yeah. It is a soundbite, and we'll tweet. It's tweetable.
Yeah.
I just don't really want to meet the first person who tells me that they're not going to vote in this election.
Right.
Because they don't like this or they don't like that. And, you know.
Right.
And that will guarantee a Trump re-election.
Without question.
Right.
You know, half this country doesn't vote. Half the eligible voters don't vote.
Right.
And I can tell you there's a preponderance of Democrats in that group of the half of natural Democrats. That's why the Republicans with smaller numbers win elections.
Or voting for candidates who have absolutely no chance of winning.
Right.
Not understanding the effects of that vote.
And then starting to dividing by running those candidates, dividing the electorate into smaller and smaller parcels, guaranteeing the right will win.
Have we heard from the Starbucks guy, by the way? Because one of the terrible things that could happen here is a third-party candidacy which rips off votes.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he's still exploring officially.
Well, yeah. Okay. And Cuddy says, Barr, I second it. Allen is right. Barr just keeping Congress off his back by offering them crumbs while he completes his investigations. John Dean looks foolish before Congress. Next, I heard Congress will be viewing all the president's men. The left keeps saying that Trump committed crimes and obstructed, but never specifics. Beto says that the polls are misleading, citing proof that all the polls showed him behind Cruz. And that's from Cotty. And by the way, somebody here said, well, shouldn't he run for Senate in Texas? Mm-hmm. Let's remember, he lost. That he didn't win when he ran the last time for governor.
Well, there'll be later this month, we'll begin to see people being winnowed out, you know, who won't be able to make more than 0% on the on the polls. And
so is Gillibrand drop out?
Well, she's doing okay as far as the number of contributors.
Well, they
has.
Got enough people. Right. Look, she's the senator. People want things from the senator. Even though she's running for president, they may give her a little something.
Well, JP's point was good. After they've been on their first two forums, you know, where they're split up into two groups, people will begin to associate names with faces and voices, and they'll hear them, and they'll begin to draw some opinions. So there's an opportunity for anybody to break out.
But and I think candidates will hang in for a while because crazy things can happen. You know, a scandal can arise with a front runner. Somebody can drop out for other reasons. I mean, it's like the Kentucky Derby where everybody, you know, gets a horse in the race and there's a huge field.
And don't you think a candidate has a moral obligation if they've accepted contributions, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions of dollars in contributions, to at least stay in a little longer before they just cash out?
I think these politicians have no moral obligations, but they do. I do think as long as you're on the debate stage, that's a valuable thing for these politicians. If you're not qualifying for debates, you're going to drop out quickly. But if you can keep going to more and more debates and get your name and face out there, what's the incentive to drop?
You know, CNN and MSNBC have been having all of these candidates on for regular interviews, and it certainly hasn't helped any of them that I can tell.
They're running for cabinet seats is what they're running for.
I just found this quote. This is from late last month. Erin McPike, who is a spokeswoman for the Howard Schultz campaign, said that if Joe Biden were to emerge as the nominee and not a bloody nominee, a moderate Democrat, Howard would definitely think twice.
In other words, he wouldn't run.
Is that, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they currently are saying that the campaign is in sleep mode.
That means dead mode.
Sleep mode. He did have back surgery, too, we should note.
Well, the other thing is that, look, there's a momentum game that you play with these campaigns. And you know, with him being the front runner right now, he could peak
early.
Joe Biden. Yeah. He could peak way too early and then fizzle out. So I understand. I mean, you know, it's very, as somebody who does this, you're right, you want to hold, sometimes you need to hold your candidates back and just keep things a little slower until you get closer and then you unleash the dogs.
What about identity politics, Libby? I mean, you know, people who say, okay, this is my person because he is closer to my most important needs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are black candidates who say, okay, you know, the best chance I have is going with a black candidate, and gay candidates, for example, mm-hmm. and the best chance I have is doing that. How important is that stuff?
Well, I think identity politics is important, and that's why and it's not going away as much as some people would like to see it go away. And I'm not one of those people. I think it's important for people to identify who they are and make political decisions based on that. I only support pro-LGBT and pro-choice candidates. So there's the identity of being a woman and being a lesbian.
Well, but that would be your first thought? In other words, you get a field and you say, okay, I'm going to pick the person who is gay.
Yes.
Not
gay, but pro-choice and pro-gay rights.
Yeah.
And
but how about gay? Let's be honest about this.
What?
Well, no, if somebody is gay.
Oh, well, look, I love Mayor Pete. It would be great. I just don't think that he can make it all the way at this point. But he's positioning himself for the future. And that's what a lot of these people are doing.
So do you have a figure of what percentage of Americans are gay?
10%.
Okay, let's assume 10%. Mm-hmm. And it'd be interesting to see if Mayor Pete, you know, exceeds that.
I think he will exceed that. I think that he's reaching across the aisle, the Democratic aisle, as it were, to the various different constituencies. He is speaking eloquently about what it is to be a gay Christian.
But he's also been effective at being a candidate who happens to be gay, not the gay candidate.
Right, right. He is a candidate. I mean, he is a candidate that happens to be gay, but he is the gay candidate. He's the first gay person who's ever run for president and has gotten any traction. There's the caveat. Who's gotten any traction whatsoever. And so I think he's somebody that we're going to be watching moving up over time. You know, and we'll see. But I, you know, I think if people don't identify,
his numbers in Iowa are good.
Right, yeah. Right, and well, he's from out there. I mean,
he's not going to be the. I don't believe he's going to be the president, but no. I believe he'll have a very good shot.
He'll have a role
cabinet.
To play. He'll have a very important role to play in this election.
Yeah,
he also has a in my mind, a, maybe even a more important identity, not more important, but more impactful, is that he is a millennial and he is young. And I think that there's a whole generation of Americans that listen to him and they don't see anybody else on the stage. Booker is also kind of young, but not really. Buttigieg is really the millennial on the stage.
Right.
And he talks to voters
but Booker
in a different way.
And Beto, they're not getting much traction.
Right.
So,
well, it could be a great part of a ticket, like Elizabeth Warren might go to Pete Buttigieg, because it would kind of close that gap for her. Midwest and male and likable and millennial.
Really?
Right.
It's a possibility.
See, I think it's preordained that it's going to be.
It's going to be Biden-Harris.
That's right. I do believe that.
Yep.
I saw a Kamala Harris lawn sign the other day in Schenectady.
She is terrific.
She's getting local support.
I really, you know, there is a part of me that says, okay, forget about all of the positioning and the politics. Who really, when you listen to them, really puts it across? She does. She puts it across. I don't, you know.
But who's listening? I mean, have the.
Well,
the
I'm
broad
listening.
Public heard her speak.
Well, they have in some cases. We saw them. You saw her work in the hearings, and she was forceful and very good. You know, I think part of our job, at least I think part of my job, is to listen to them and to see whether or not they impress me. I'm a big Elizabeth Warren supporter. I'm proud she's my senator and the rest of it. But I don't think she's as effective as Kamala in putting it over.
And it's not a minor thing that she's a sitting senator from California.
Sure.
I mean, that's already
that's
a
right.
lot of votes.
Well, a lot of people are saying, well, that's why she shouldn't be the vice presidential candidate, because whoever the Democrat is already has California. But I don't think so. I don't think that matters. I think what matters is the dint of her personality.
All right.
Discount her being the presidential candidate.
Okay.
We're gonna take a break. The governor is on the line. We'll go to that and talking to Alan right after this.